Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And as I always do at the moment, it's Wednesday, so I'm doing a Wednesday book review. And I want to talk mainly today about the works of Linda Colley. This, by the way, nothing's been sent to me by IB Tours this week. This is simply my kind of admiration and fascination by Linda Colley and her writing. And there are two books that I want to discuss today. The first, obviously, being her seminal work, Britons, which was published in the early 1990s, and the subtitle being Forging the Nation, 1707 to 1837, so from the Act of Union through to the coronation of Queen Victoria, that long 18th century that really sees the development of a British national identity. And then she wrote an interesting book of essays 2 years ago called Acts of Union and Disunion, which were featured as discussions on Radio 4. And the two books together are extremely important ways of navigating really the crisis that Great Britain exists in at the moment, from independence referendums in Scotland through to Brexit. Britain is going through a prolonged and protracted series of existential questions about national identity. Now, obviously, the point that Linda Colley makes in Britons is that you have three kingdoms and a principality, England, Scotland, Ireland and Wales, fused together in this one kind of multinational, a multi-ethnic conglomeration, which is dominated by England. So much of what is considered to be British national identity really ultimately is English national identity that is transposed to some extent willingly and others with reluctance onto the other parts of the British Isles. But Linda Colley says that there are a number of key explanations for this, the development of a sense of Britishness. Not just the political act of unifying Scotland and England and Wales, and later Ireland in 1800, but the actual development of a sense of shared national identity of people considering themselves to be British as opposed to being English or Scottish. This develops partly due to the growth in commerce and trade and empire, i.e. There was great business to be done in the 18th and 19th centuries, and the new Britons together could have a part to play in that. Scottish, Welsh and Irish histories, often the Celtic role in things like empire and the slave trade is rather played down.
but you only need to look in the records of countries like Barbados and Jamaica to find the a wide variety of Welsh, Scottish and Irish plantation owners, ship's captains transporting slaves backward and forth, investors in the slave trade, plantation overseers, so on and so forth. So it is far from being an exclusively English enterprise, despite how comforting that might be. So trade was important, empire was important, but also Protestantism. The development of a Protestant British Isles seemingly under siege from the monstrous overseas Catholic threat, which when you read about it and you read about the kind of the obsessional fear of Catholicism in Diane Purkis's The English Civil War, A People's History, the fear of Catholicism seems to be almost slightly analogous to McCarthyite anti-communism in the 1950s. There are, on the eve of the Civil War, all sorts of ludicrous conspiracy theories that the Catholics are sabotaging bridges and planning assassinations and all sorts of ridiculous things. And there's an interesting bit in Diane Purkis's book where it goes back into the early life of John Pym, who apparently one of the chief Puritan parliamentarians who conspires to defy the king. And one of his earliest recollections, so the story goes, is that of the Spanish Armada sailing along the English coast. The sort of experience that would perhaps clearly go on to shape the rest of his life and his views of Catholicism. So there has been this sense of anti-Catholicism in the British Isles, and that means that the indigenous Catholic peoples of Ireland and the Catholics who continue to live in England, Wales and Scotland obviously found their relationship with this new sense of Britishness at best complicated, perhaps reluctant, and perhaps existed as they would have done as anti-Catholic laws were introduced in the 16th, 17th and later 18th centuries, particularly in Ireland, as outsiders and in many ways victims of this new British state. The culture of Britishness that emerges as a country that sees itself, and every country has this myth in some way or another, and sees itself as exceptional or has this notion of exceptionalism about it, is manifested religiously in the 18th century by various theologians and writers referring to England as Jerusalem and the English as the Israelites. Righteous and the noble who are God's elect, God's chosen people, and who have this this sceptred isle in which to live. Now that's all fine and well, but the thing that really interests me is the processes by which national identity in general are formed. And I know I go on about it a lot, but you can't do far better than getting Benedict Anderson's book, Imagined Communities, and he explores the different stages of the development of national identity. He has a very, very eclectic approach and looks at how it's been formed in different parts of the world. But in general, in specific time periods, there are clear factors that make the development of national identity, particularly in Europe, almost kind of a unified process. One of those is the decline in the notion that the transnational or the international notion of Christendom. So the idea that a Christian in England, a Christian in Germany, or a Christian in France might have a shared sense of national identity. If this ever was the case, certainly by the 16th century, it's in steep decline. The power of the church to be able to exert this transnational notion of solidarity is in decline. And why? Because new ideas of conceiving of identity are in the rise, with an increase in literacy across Europe and an increase in publishing. People are basically able to read and write and talk and discuss about who they are and what their countries stand for. And you have an increase in publishing in the vernacular language. So you've got a decline in Latin. People aren't reading it any or people aren't publishing it any longer. Not that many people could read it anyway. And priests are not, are less inclined to do sermons in Latin, as there's a pressure for vernacular teaching. And as people began to speak and discuss and talk about religion, which is the main ideological and cultural epicentre of their worlds, in German or in English, in their respective countries. So a sense of a weakening of bonds to Rome occurs, and a weakening of the idea of Christendom, which has been based really on the old structures of the Roman Empire anyway, that occurs. And you get the opportunity for new political thinking. If you look at the past histories, the life stories of people like Thomas Cromwell, for example, two of his great inspirations were both Martin Luther and Niccolo Machiavelli, both of whom discuss about the need for a king to be sovereign in his realm, not to be answerable to a transnational force. And the only one that they would possibly be referring to would have been Rome. And the Reformation, the break with Rome, really is a kind of an indication of this notion of a rise in distinct national identities. It would be difficult to suggest that Tudor England was experiencing what you would call nationalism, but some of the foundations for later nationalism are definitely there. It's interesting now, here in the 21st century, the references, the Brexit references that are, or the Henry VIII references that are included within various Brexit discussions and ideas. So the other bookend book, if you will, in this discussion is Acts of Union and Disunion by Linda Colley. And this was, again, out in 2014 and extremely prescient, as it discussed the possible breakup of the European Union. It actually looks at the United States as well, and looks at how the union, the political union in the United States, may well hold together, almost certainly will hold together, but the society that exists alongside it has become more fragmented than ever. And the overall point that she makes, which she discusses the fall of the Soviet Union in there, and the overall point that she makes throughout the book is that political unions very often outlast the economic and social conditions that prefigure them. Society is changing all the time. The world is being economically transformed through technology and innovation all the time. And institutions are always playing catch-up. The institutions have, by their very nature, fixed ideological preconceptions, fixed economic structures, and they are bureaucratic and unwieldy. And they can't keep pace with the dramatic changes that are sweeping the world, particularly in the 21st century, with things like automation and the development of artificial intelligence, and you know, even the possibility of mass human redundancy in the next decade or so. So those are all the crises for the future anyway, and this podcast is about the past, so let's get back on focus. But yes, Linda Connie makes the point that the unions that really underpin the world, the United Kingdom, the United States, the European Union, and even the Soviet Union, have lifespans. And the problem for us when we think about the possibility of the end of the United Kingdom, which is a distinct possibility, depending on what happens in Scotland, is that we conceive of them in terms of permanence. And why wouldn't we? Our entire culture is designed to foster this notion. Our public acts of memorialisation for the First World War, the on Remembrance Sunday, things like the Cenotaph and institutions as varied as the Royal Albert Hall to the BBC, give us this notion that the world in which we live has fixed, firm foundations that are immovable. And the reality is that's not the case. Institutions, I mean, one of the reasons why Great Britain has a durable parliamentary democracy is that it evolves, shifts and changes periodically when it experiences insurmountable external challenges, such as the demand for suffrage throughout the 19th century. And we need to create the myth of permanence. I mean, nationalism does this very well. It is a decidedly modern idea that needs to go deep into the past and cherry-pick aspects of a national story to give a sense of coherence that all people really thrive on, a sense of a long and normally rather glorious story with the rather murky bits edited out, in order to help people try to navigate the senses of national identity in the present, who they are, and what they are meant to be doing as national citizens. And Benedict Anderson points out that, you know, if you were to, you know, perhaps come down from Mars and look at the idea of nations and national identity, it really is rather a curious institution that we've created for ourselves. And this extra layer of identity that human beings seem to need, other than individual parent, son, father, mother, daughter, that kind of thing. Britain, Scots, Welsh, Irish, American, or multiplicities of that, have an important role to play. And I suppose that as people become more literate, as people become more armed with information, or they're able to access more information, thus questions about where one sits in this complicated world that we now inhabit and encounter, and what one's identity, what one's sense of shared past is, become more pressing. You only need to go and look at the points that Orlando Figes makes in Russia, A People's Tragedy, when he talks about the peasants of Russia in the late 19th century, who would identify with their village. And, you know, based on the information they have about the world, if you were to ask a 19th century Russian peasant where they come from, he would probably point at the soil and say, well, I'm from here. I'm a man of this place. And so information, the development of information, and the various information revolutions we've been through since the Renaissance have had a distinct bearing on notions of national identity. Anyway, I commend to you very greatly Britain's by Linda Colley, Acts of Union and Disunion by Linda Colley, of course, Imagined Communities by Benedict Anderson. And another great read, if you're fascinated by the ideas in this podcast and the ideas of British national identity, is David Reynolds' The Long Shadow. And the point that he makes in that book is that the kind of the fissile nature of British national identity, that we are destined to split up at some point, was really put on hold by the crises of the 20th century. Two world wars and the experience of Cold War David Reynolds suggests, has really acted as a kind of a glue that's held the United Kingdom together, and a stay of execution that has given it an unnaturally long lease of life. And now that the Cold War is over, in the decades that have followed it, gradually those bonds have weakened. Whether this is the case or not, we shall have to see. Anyway, I hope you found that interesting, and I'll catch you later this week with more art from the Explaining History podcast. Remember, go give us a like, go onto iTunes, find the podcast, give us a 5-star review. It'll do the podcast a world of good, and we can keep supplying you with awesome content. Take care. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.